This is Josh Barrow, and welcome to Left, Right, and Center, your civilized yet provocative antidote to the self-contained opinion bubbles that dominate political debate. It is the third week of March, and this week, President Joe Biden gave the first formal press conference of his presidency. Biden faced a lot of questions Thursday about issues that have been pushed out of the headlines by the two biggest stories since the start of his administration: the vaccination campaign aimed at stopping the COVID pandemic, and the relief legislation designed to ameliorate the pandemic's economic effects. In the second and third segments of today's show, we're going to focus on two of those major topics: immigration and the situation with unaccompanied minors arriving at the U.S.-Mexico border, and U.S. relations with China. But Biden started the press conference with a bit of a victory lap. He noted that economic forecasts for this year keep improving, with 6% growth expected as we rebound strongly from the virus. He also touted meeting his 100 million shots goal in just 58 days of his administration. Now, I would note, a lot of us were saying 100 million shots in 100 days was always too low a target and that Biden was sandbagging a bit. Now he says he's going to go for 200 million shots in 100 days, which is a figure he will also almost surely be able to beat. Biden also noted that $1,400 relief payments have already gone out to over 100 million people. To talk about that record and what stands in the future for this administration, let's bring in our Left, Right, and Center panel. As always, I'm your center. I'm joined by Megan McArdle, columnist at the Washington Post on the right. Hello, Megan.
Hi.
And on the left, Christine Emba, also a columnist and an editor at the Washington Post. Hello, Christine.
Hello, Josh.
So, Christine, as we'll discuss later in the show, some of these other issues I think are going to be thornier politically for Biden, but he explicitly said at this press conference, these two issues, COVID and the economy, were the most important ones he would face at the start of his administration. That's been his core focus. Is the victory lap called for here on those two items?
You know, I'm not sure that a victory lap is called for because obviously people still have COVID and are getting COVID. It is still a threat. However, we have seen pretty extreme advances since the end of the Trump presidency and through the beginning of the Biden presidency. Vaccination no longer seems like something that's happening way off in the future. You know, it's happening now. It's happening before people even expected. You know, that his target date is May 1st. We're already seeing people begin to plan summer vacations, talking about when they will get back together with their friends and families. The light at the end of the tunnel seems like it's actually coming closer to us now instead of existing far off into the distance. And I think that we have some of the Biden administration's pushes on vaccination, on testing sites, on getting schools reopened, to thank for that. So yeah, the problem isn't over. Again, I'd also have to include, of course, the American Rescue Act, actually, you know, extending unemployment benefits, sending out those Biden bucks. Even if you disagreed with that, that did also make the American people, I think, feel more supported in this crisis and, you know, more ready to face the next few months. I think that sense of buoyedness and, you know, increased safety is a big shift.
Megan, what do you make of that? Christine notes the reopening of schools. That's another area where President Biden had set a target that I think a lot of people reasonably said was not an aggressive enough target, that half of schools would be back to in-person instruction within his first 100 days. He noted that approximately 48% of schools are already back full-time, so they're almost at that target. But I think a lot of people would like to go farther and faster than that. Do you see this record as one that the president has good reason to crow about?
Well, also, he's getting a lot of boost there on from red states that were going to reopen their schools regardless, right? I mean, there's a huge amount of Biden taking credit for stuff that was already going to happen. You see this with the vaccination targets. Now, I think the administration has done some good things in terms of buying more vaccine supply, which was something where the Trump administration towards the end was kind of just inexplicably not moving on. And I think ultimately that's probably because Trump was so distracted by the election. But that was good, but that's not actually really showing up right now. What's really showing up right now is the stuff that was kind of baked into the cake. On the one hand, the vaccine supply that had already been secured, and on the other hand, the fact that as you vaccinated more people and as cases kind of fell naturally, both because we're coming off of the holiday spike, the weather's getting a little better, I think those two things, you were going to see an economic surge. And that's great, but that's not because Biden did it. It's just because that was what was going to happen as soon as we got people into a place where they could go out more and socialize more. And, you know, similarly on the recent COVID relief, I supported the unemployment portion of that bill, thought most of the rest of it was too big and yet curiously lacking in things like support for small businesses. But that said, you know, we spent $5.3 trillion on this pandemic in the last slightly over a year. Most of that was spent not by Joe Biden, but by Donald Trump. I don't think it's that this is some sort of massive break and like Joe Biden is going where Donald Trump did not dare to go. In fact, both administrations spent a lot. I think in general, spending a lot on coronavirus was appropriate to support the economy when people were home. I would like to see that withdrawn as people leave the house. But, you know, I don't actually think there's a big sea change. I think what Joe Biden is actually proven really good at right now is just setting an absurdly low target. Like, you know, when he said they were going to vaccinate 100 million people, that was actually slightly less than the rate at which the administration had already been vaccinating people when he took office.
100 million shots. Which 100 wasn't million even 100 shots, million
right?
People.
So not even 100 million, right? That was actually like way underclaiming, right? You know, I can't fault the politics. There are areas where I would like to see him be more ambitious. You know, I think when we look at the AstraZeneca vaccine, that we didn't lean harder on getting that approved faster or exporting faster to countries near us like Canada and Mexico that could use it. Those are areas where I would have liked to have seen him do more. But, you know, in general, I think that he came in at a propitious time, and I can hardly blame him for taking credit for that.
We're entering this interesting point in the recovery where, you know, I think Megan lays out a good argument that a lot of what Biden did fairly well over the last 2 months were extensions of things that we were doing for the prior year. Yet another round of relief, similar in structure, probably significantly bigger than it would have been if Republicans had been involved in drafting it, and continuing to accelerate this vaccine rollout that was already speeding up when he took office. But we're going to have a new set of challenges in the next few months about renormalizing the economy. This was probably the last big relief package. It's going to be questions of when we can go back to more normal operation and things. Similarly with the vaccine, it's going to be a shift from trying to get out vaccine as fast as possible to people who really, really want it, to trying to get people to take up the vaccine who are maybe more hesitant about it. And so do you see, Christine, signs that the Biden administration is ready for that shift and for this response that's not just, you know, trying to go faster and better than the Trump administration, but actually really doing things that are different in kind?
I think that there are some likely signs. One of the things that this new administration will have to do, as you say, is to convince more people to get the vaccine. You saw, you know, even at the beginning of the administration, at the very beginning, the president teamed up with past presidents to have his shot filmed, made a video, was like doing press around popularizing the idea of getting vaccinated. One of the challenges that we're seeing with, you know, the vaccination uptick in certain populations is just like fear, lack of knowledge, sort of dislike. And so it seems like they have a good sense that what will be needed there is, you know, almost influencing, you know, social media strategies, persuasion tactics. And from what we've seen so far, it does sound like they're working on that, at least, you know, from what I've seen so far, just like listening to local radio, you know, from looking on the internet, from talking to, you know, parents and friends and other family, like the message is getting out there that the vaccine is good and normal and you should have it. One of the things that Biden also said in the press conference was that the next big project that he's going to unveil at the end of the week is infrastructure, not week, but month, year. And I think that's an indication that he will be turning to sort of projects for economic revamp, things that will hopefully make people more excited about the economy, about getting back to work, that will actually help to produce jobs, which I also think is the next step in, you know, post-pandemic life, is trying to restart the economy. So I think there are some eyes on the future, but I also think we'll have to wait and see.
Yeah, I think there were a number of times in this press conference that Biden turned to infrastructure, and we know that the plan is for an infrastructure package in the later this year, possibly with some tax provisions tied to it. But one time that he brought up infrastructure was when he was asked about gun policy and the two mass shootings that we've seen over the last couple of weeks and the prospects for gun legislation in Congress. And Biden basically gave this answer where he said, quote, "Successful presidents better than me have been successful in large part because they know how to time what they're doing in order to assign priorities, what needs to be done." And then he went on to talk about infrastructure, which is his stated priority for later this year. And so I was looking at that. Is that, Megan, the president basically saying, you know, we're not really going to try something on guns because we don't think that we can get, you know, something important through?
Look, I think getting something important through is a heroic lift, as earlier administrations have found in a bunch of different ways. You know, number one, you can kind of nibble around the very edges, but the problem is that the nibbles don't actually do anything. I mean, look, you know, you want to close the gun show loophole, as it is called, which is basically a private sale loophole, is that you don't have to run a background check if you sell if you sell your gun to someone privately. You know, I think there's an argument for doing that, but I just don't think it really moves the needle much on especially these kinds of crimes, these mass shootings, where these are shooters who don't really, you know, the thing about mass shooters is they tend not to have a history with law enforcement in the way that, say, felony murderers do. They aren't necessarily mentally ill or not mentally ill in a way that has caused them to come into contact with the system. Even in cases where they have, like Adam Lanza at Newtown, you know, it was his mother's guns. He stole them and then shot her. It's you know, so it's incredibly hard, actually, to come up with something that is constitutional, doesn't involve, you know, really, really violating kind of a lot of Supreme Court precedent at this point, that actually meaningfully gets guns out of private hands. There are, I mean, we don't even have a good estimate, but hundreds of millions of them in private hands in the United States, and they're just floating around, and you have to make policy that accounts for that. And Democrats are aware of that. And they're also aware of what is basically an intensity gradient that is very different on the gun owner side from the gun controller side, which is that in the wake of these shootings, you can get, you know, really large polls for reasonable gun control. Although part of the problem is that reasonable gun control tends not to actually map all that well onto things that would actually meaningfully reduce these kinds of crimes. But the problem is that that intensity kind of spikes up right after these events, and then it wanes really fast. Gun owners, by contrast, especially the people who are collectors, who may have 10 or 20 different guns, they're intense about the issue all the time. And the people who get very interested in some sort of gun control, not only is it time limited, it's not the only issue they vote on, right? If you ask, if it's someone who really cares about, say, immigration, and you ask them, like, are you going to override your preferences on immigration and instead vote gun control? In general, they're not. Whereas, again, the gun owners will vote on that issue every single time. And that difference in intensity makes it incredibly difficult as a political issue, because even though you may have something that looks like it has large majority support, that large majority is not actually going to vote for you or vote against you on this issue. And that intense minority is absolutely going to vote against you on that issue, which makes it incredibly difficult to craft more than very small ball issues that aren't actually going to do much. And it means that it's not necessarily, I think, rationally a good use of political capital, even though I'm sure that I have a lot of listeners right now who are very angry at me for saying this and at Joe Biden for presumably thinking it.
Christine, it's interesting to me that the focus on this issue is coming in this week and obviously in the aftermath of these two high-profile shootings. But in 2020, and crime data lags in a way that is infuriating, and so it's hard to get a good real-time picture. You know, we know more about the, you know, how many soybeans were sold last week than how many murders were committed last week in the United States. But we're getting clear evidence that there was a spike in murders in cities around the country in 2020. And it's not completely clear why. There are a lot of plausible theories about why that would be the case. But it seems to me that, you know, that we went a year without high profile mass shootings, in part because of the disruptions to society due to the pandemic that reduced the extent to which people are gathered in crowds together. But it was actually a worse year for violence, including gun violence. And then it's only, you know, it's now with society coming back, and that apparently includes mass shootings coming back. What do you make of that trajectory on the issue, and where, you know, is gun control the best place for federal policymakers to be focusing on that? Or what are other things, if they're trying to address that issue, not just this year, but last year, what should they be doing to address it?
I mean, the issue of rising violence, gun control would help, obviously, but, you know, rising violence, especially when it's concentrated as it has been this year and the past year, in cities and urban centers is just a multifaceted problem, right? I think you're seeing a lot of attention paid to gun access and mass shootings because obviously those are the ones that are very visible, you know, become sort of media splash events that seem to really hit us hard and make us afraid, because that could happen to anyone. But as we saw, as you see, even looking at the lagging crime statistics now, much of this rise in crime has happened in urban centers. It's in communities that have, you know, been underfunded and undercovered for years, in fact. And I think that the pullback of funding, the pullback of monitoring under COVID-19, not to mention the, you know, lack of economic growth, the lack of, you know, outlets in which young people, young men especially, who are often responsible for some of this violence, can spend their time, has, you know, just contributed to more unease. I think that the long-term approach would be to begin to think of ways to reinvest in these communities, to get, you know, youths who would otherwise be you know, subject to violence or, you know, in violent situations on track, whether it's back in school, having schools opened, having better economic opportunities, etc. Guns are just one part of this. And, you know, because they're so, I guess, tactile, it seems like an easy fix. But the problem is simply much larger.
Let's take a break. I've been talking with Megan McArdle and Christine Emba of The Washington Post. We will come back to talk about immigration and the situation at the U.S.-Mexico border. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
You're hearing from our left, right, and center, and we want to hear from you, too. Tweet us at LRCKCRW and download the free KCRW app to listen to Left, Right, and Center on demand.
Support for Left, Right, and Center comes from Odoo. If you feel like you're wasting time and money with your current business software, or just want to know what you could be missing, then you need to join the millions of other users who switch to Odoo. Odoo is the affordable, all-in-one management software with a library of fully integrated business applications that help you get more done in less time for a fraction of the price. To learn more, visit odoo.com/LRC. That's odoo.com/LRC. Odoo, modern management made simple.
Back again with Left, Right, and Center, I'm Josh Barrow. On the right is Megan McArdle, columnist at The Washington Post. On the left is Christine Emba, also a columnist and an editor at The Washington Post. Your colleagues at The Washington Post report that it is likely that U.S. officials at the Mexican border will take 17,000 unaccompanied minors seeking to enter the United States into custody this month, which would be a record. As the Biden administration notes, migration flows tend to be seasonal, with migrants seeking to cross the border in the winter when temperatures are more moderate. And as Biden himself noted at a press conference Thursday, the Biden administration has largely continued the Trump policy of turning back single adults and families seeking to enter the country.
If you take a look at the number of people who are coming, the vast majority, the overwhelming majority of people coming to the border and crossing are being sent back. Thousands, tens of thousands of people who are over 18 years of age and single, people, one at a time coming, have been sent back, sent home. We're sending back the vast majority of the families that are coming. We're trying to work out now with Mexico their willingness to take more of those families back. But that's what's happening. They're not getting across the border.
But the unprecedented peak in crossings by unaccompanied minors is tied to a policy choice of the Biden administration. Unlike with families and single adults, as the president described there, unaccompanied minors who arrive at the U.S. border are generally being released into the United States, pending proceedings on whether they will be permitted to stay here for the long term. And there was a question about this from ABC News's Cecilia Vega, to which I thought the president gave an answer that actually really seemed unsatisfactory. Vega talked about a 9-year-old that she met at the border who had traveled from Honduras, trying to escape conditions in that country. And as President Biden noted, you know, it would have to be some pretty horrible conditions to send your child all the way from there to enter the United States unaccompanied in order to get away from them. And the president was evoking sympathy for that. But then Vega asked, well, you know, what becomes of this child who has entered the United States? You're going to put him through some proceedings about deportation. Will this child be deported? And this is how that exchange went.
Quick follow, if I may. Do you want to see these unaccompanied minors staying in this country, or should they be deported eventually?
Well, the judgment has to be made whether or not, in this young man's case, he has a mom at home. There's an overwhelming reason why he'd be put in a plane and flown back to his mom.
Christine, I don't understand what the guiding principle of the policy is here. If the shift from the Trump administration policy, where we were directly deporting unaccompanied minors back to their home countries, is about concern for the conditions in which these children were living that caused them to come to the United States. But the president's view is also, well, you know, in a situation like that, maybe the ultimate disposition of those proceedings should be that the child gets deported. I don't understand how you can hold those two positions at the same time.
Yeah, I would also say that was a kind of odd and seemingly incomplete answer. What it sounded like he was saying to me was something more along the lines of, well, we should try and reunite children with their parents. We should, like, this kid apparently has a mom at home. We should, like, make sure that's the case. And if so, send him back to his family, which is, I guess, different than saying, yeah, we've got to get them out of the country, like chuck them in an airplane willy-nilly, we'll assume there's a parent at home. But yeah, that's kind of that's a distinction in degree. It doesn't really feel like a policy difference to me. But, you know, then again, I guess it didn't necessarily seem like Biden had promised, or at least is currently promising, a hugely different policy when it comes to deportations and monitoring the border, but something of a more humane approach almost, which also weirdly is something that reporters kept asking him at this press conference. You know, are more people coming over the border because they think that you, Joe Biden, are a nice man who will take care of them? And he said no. But I'm not sure he was right.
Yeah, Megan, I'm not sure that he's right about that either. I see a lot of this as a mixed message. I mean, you know, ultimately, the message that the president sometimes seems to be trying to send, which I think is, you know, it's different from the tenor of a lot of stuff that you saw during the campaign. But it's basically, you know, that the border is closed, that you can't come to the United States simply because conditions are poor in the country that you're coming from. There are specific reasons that people can be eligible for asylum in the United States. And some people trying to enter from Central America will qualify for that. But it has to be something about your specific status rather than just, you know, general conditions of insecurity or of economic depression in the country that you're coming from. But this shift on the unaccompanied minors seems to send that message in the other direction. And as Cecilia Vega noted, this child's mother said that she sent him to the United States because her understanding was that he would be admitted to the United States. And in fact, unaccompanied minors are being admitted to the United States, at least temporarily.
Yeah, Democrats have a real problem, which is that, like, the immigration faction of the Democratic Party functionally wants open borders. No one is saying the words open borders, but if you don't enforce your borders, then that is functionally what you have. So, you know, that's not even the majority of the Democratic Party, but it is a really, really, to go back to what I said about guns, it's a really, really motivated small faction of the Democratic Party, and you cannot please them unless, if you say anything that sounds too close to, yes, we are actually going to crack down, and if you come here illegally, you're going to be sent home. And that has led to a couple of things. One is that, and this is a long-standing problem, Trump obviously had it, but that people figured out that you could use the asylum process to at least work in the United States for a couple of years. The Trump administration cracked down on that. But now, you know, Trump is gone, And people are kind of figuring that, especially with the unaccompanied minor thing, where, yes, they are being released into the United States. So Biden basically has two audiences he wants to speak to. He wants to speak to that immigration faction in the Democratic Party and be like, see, I am a lovely person who is allowing unaccompanied minors in here because they are decent, hardworking, the kids of decent, hardworking people who just want them to have a better life. But to the people in other countries, he wants to say, like, no, this is terrible. It will be horrible. You will never be allowed in. Do not send your children here. And you can't, you know, he's the problem with being the president of the United States is that you cannot say those two things at once, right? If you speak to one group, you will be heard by the other group. And he has chosen mostly to speak to the immigration faction in the Democratic Party. And that means that until he figures out some alternative policy, and I don't know what that would look like, we are going to continue to see people flooding the borders. There will be some seasonal aspect, but especially as COVID dies down and it becomes easier to make those transits, I would actually expect it to rise, not fall, unless the Democratic Party can kind of get some sort of consensus on something that is not, we never enforce our borders. And I think that's a problem for him.
I think some of the conversation about the open borders terminology is more heat than light, because a lot of people in the Democratic Party coalition who are looking for a softer and more open approach here, it's not that the borders would be open generally. It's a question of to whom the borders are open. And so I guess, Christine, is the idea what the Democratic Party ought to be standing for, is the pressure that Joe Biden is facing here, is it that, you know, generally people who come to the U.S. from Central America who are facing, you know, problematic security or economic conditions in the United States, that they should be able to enter the country, that they should be able to enter the country if they are under 18 and they have relatives to join here in the United States, as is very often the case with these unaccompanied minors? Because it seems to me that there are clear policies that you could lay out there that are not simply the border is open and anyone can come in, that would be clear about who can come in, that would be more permissive than what the policy is right now. Is that what people are looking for from the Biden administration?
Yeah, I think you get at a great point there with your comment that this seems more heat than light. And actually, in this press conference, Biden gave like a really, I think, correct answer on this question. He suggested that Republican threats not to deal with immigration reform until, you know, we've somehow decided that the question of the border is fixed and secure, it's just posturing. Like, Republicans have to shout a bit about like how the border is unsecure and open borders, et cetera, et cetera. They just need to posture a little while and like get it out of their system. And then both parties can actually come together and think about what sort of nuanced fixes will work. But unfortunately, like that is a process that will take communication, disagreement, hopefully some compromise and agreement, and then like real policies can be worked out. But if both parties continue to use the question of immigration as sort of a shouting box, then nothing is going to change. I think Biden is maybe trying to walk the line a little bit, you know, almost say nothing, I guess, apart from, you know, general pains to humanity and kindness and humane treatment of migrants until some actual policy can be worked out. But I'm just not sure how long that's going to last.
Megan, I want to shift and look a little more forward toward longer run immigration reform. But I guess first, do you buy the frame that you hear from Republicans that basically until we fix the border situation, it doesn't make sense to talk about longer run immigration policy? And if that does make sense, has the border ever been fixed? And you know, was there a time in recent U.S. history that the border was under such control that it would make sense to start having that conversation?
I think what we have on the immigration issue, you know, in part because this was allowed to fester for so long, right? I mean, for you know, more than a decade, basically, you kind of had a bipartisan consensus that what you were going to do was talk about immigration enforcement. But that was something that, like, parts of the Republican Party base, and frankly, back then, parts of the Democratic Party base, many of whom are now in the Republican Party, that they really cared about. But the people who were running the party, the establishment, especially like business leaders and donors, they didn't want the border enforced. And so what you had was basically a kind of bipartisan consensus that you might talk about eventually, you know, enforcement. But what you would really do was fairly laxly enforce things so that it was fairly easy to get into this country and stay here. And that was stable until it suddenly wasn't. And Donald Trump exploited that. And so now what you have is that you have Republican senators and congressmen who may themselves actually not really have changed their opinion that much, but they are beholden to voters who, for whom this has become kind of a totem that you have to, you must honor. And so for those people, the issue that they're looking at is they need a credible commitment. Because what they're afraid of, not unreasonably, is that what you do is you say, okay, well, we're going to fix the legalization side. We're going to, you know, set path to citizenship and all the rest of it. And then we will do some sort of unspecified, we'll strengthen the border. But the problem with that is if that comes later and you do the amnesty process now, then they're worried about a repeat of what they see as having happened under Biden and Reagan, where you got the amnesty, the enforcement never arrived, and you know the numbers just kept climbing. And they don't want to repeat that. And therefore, there needs to be some sort of upfront, credible commitment to like, yes, we can control the flows. And I do not think the Republicans are going to be willing to talk about a path to citizenship or anything else until you've at least shown that it is possible to keep a lot of new future citizens from arriving without permission.
I think it's actually even harder than that politically. I think there's that issue that you're describing about the lack of trust, but I think the even bigger issue that prevents a deal is that the idea behind immigration reform used to be sort of that, you know, we would have better enforcement and we'd have an amnesty and then we'd have some sort of policy change that would lead to probably a net increase in the amount of legal immigration into the United States, maybe with some changes about who it would be, but more people in total. Now, the demand from Trump and from the people close to him who were making immigration policy, like Stephen Miller and some key people in Congress, is that in addition to all the enforcement, they want a reduction in net immigration to the United States. So it's just actually farther away from there being any sort of bipartisan agreement to be reached. So I think, you know, I think there's this reflexive idea that this is supposed to be a subject for a bipartisan deal because maybe you could have made one in 2006, 2007. But I don't really think there's the space there for a bipartisan remake of immigration policy.
Yeah, no, I think I agree with you. I think a big difference that is not necessarily underreported or under-discussed, but perhaps doesn't always rise to clarity in people's minds is that this has gone from kind of a pragmatic issue in the past to almost sort of a psychological, psychosocial issue in the present, where the debate is not between, you know, the number of immigrants we should let in and or why, to at least on the right, on the conservative side, a lot of the time, to a sort of moral question about nationalism and who gets to be an American and what America should look like and what it will mean if we let other people in. You know, that speaks to, yeah, questions of nationalism, perhaps questions of racism, questions of class competition. But it's much bigger than just, you know, picking one policy and calling it a day.
And I think that's also true on the left, I would say, is that, you know, it's become harder and harder for Democrats to articulate any reason other than, as I say, committing a violent felony, that America would have the right to say, no, you know what, we get to decide who lives here. They, you know, the leadership certainly has become uncomfortable with the principle that America has a right to determine who becomes an American citizen. And you put those two poles in the same polity, even though I think there's actually a pretty big middle ground in between, but it's just not represented in the official positions of those part of either party. And that makes it very hard to come to an agreement.
Well, I mean, it depends on where, though. I mean, we did have Biden saying on Thursday, you know, most of these people who are arriving at the border, we're sending them back. That was a message that, you know, that was, you know, we are enforcing the border and border enforcement is an appropriate thing for the government to do. So, but I do agree that there's a bit of a dissonance there between that and some of the broader messaging from the Democratic Party. I do want to leave this here. I've been talking with Megan McArdle and Christine Emba of The Washington Post. We will be back with Kaiser Kuo to talk about U.S.-China relations and Biden's thoughts on that from Thursday. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
You're hearing civilized yet provocative opinions from all sides. Now we need to know what you think. Tweet us at LRCKCRW. Stream all episodes of Left, Right, and Center and our companion show, All the President's Lawyers, at kcrw.com/podcasts or from the KCRW app.
Back again with Left, Right, and Center, I'm your host, Josh Barrow. On the right is Megan McArdle, columnist at The Washington Post. On the left, Christine Emba is also a columnist and an editor at The Washington Post. At Thursday's press conference, Bloomberg reporter Justin Sink asked Joe Biden a number of pretty specific questions about the U.S. relationship with China. He asked Biden whether, in response to the very frosty summit that the U.S. just had with China in Anchorage, Alaska, whether Biden was more inclined to do certain things like keep in place the tariffs that President Trump had imposed on China, whether he might seek to impose restrictions on goods made with forced labor in China, and whether he might try to restrict Chinese access to international payment systems. Biden didn't really answer the question. He did give a long answer about his personal relationship with Xi Jinping, formed when Biden had been vice president, and about his understanding of Xi's goals and outlook. He noted that Xi is smart, but that he does not have a democratic bone in his body. That was Biden's quote. And he laid out certain ways in which our objectives and his objectives conflict. But he didn't really say what he was going to do about it, other than that he would relentlessly bring attention to human rights abuses in China. To talk about that, I want to bring in a special guest, Kaiser Kuo. Kaiser is editor-at-large at Sup China and co-host and co-founder of the Seneca podcast. Hello, Kaiser.
Hey, Josh.
So what did you learn from Biden's answers in this press conference regarding China?
Well, I think that Biden probably has in his mind, at least subconsciously, a desire to avoid inflammatory language in answering any questions about China right now, because Atlanta is still just in the very recent rearview mirror. He was pretty forthright, but I don't think, again, he didn't answer the questions directly, but nor did he engage in any gratuitous name-calling. And I think, he most importantly, he led with this idea, which is consonant with what he's been pushing all along, this idea that I happen to completely agree with, that to compete with China, we have to focus on ourselves, run faster and stop trying to trip the other guy. He talked about, increasing spending on fundamental scientific research, on R&D, and that was fantastic. He talked about infrastructure. I think, we see Biden's putting his money where his mouth is.
But is that really, there's all sorts of reasons why you might spend money on infrastructure in the United States, but does that really have a large impact on our global position with regard to China, especially in the short term? It seems to me like there are a number of these issues that have arisen over the last few years that you have to directly engage with, even if just to say, we're going to ease off on that. We're not going to make this a key point of contention. It seems like you have to say more than just, we're going to focus on ourselves.
Right. Well, I think he understands he's operating in an environment where his political options are pretty circumscribed. Trump did his absolute best to box him in. On the way out, Pompeo left a lot of, policy turds on the lawn. Taiwan, declaring that the Xinjiang atrocity is a full-blown genocide. He's got to navigate this. He's not able to appear soft. At the same time, obviously, he doesn't want to inflame Sinophobia at a kind of sensitive moment right now, where Sinophobia, I think a lot of us recognize, was one of the contributing factors to this surge in anti-Asian hate crime in the United States that culminated, or hopefully culminated, with the killings in Atlanta.
What is the way to balance that? We've already seen, official state Chinese outlets noting that environment within the United States, and obviously we want to avoid being inflammatory in ways that has blowback on people within the United States. But we also need to be able to talk about the U.S.-China relationship. What is the way to talk about those points of contention without, as you describe, ending up being domestically inflammatory?
Well, I think we have to recognize that there's nobody right now attacking Asians or Asian American people in the streets in the United States right now out of a sense of solidarity with the Uyghurs or out of concern for the atrocity that's happening in Xinjiang. There's nobody who's attacking Asian Americans or perpetrating hate crimes in the United States out of a concern for the security of Taiwan or out of worries about the erosion of democratic rights in Hong Kong, the abolition of democratic rights in Hong Kong. That's not why they're doing it. But there's a whole another set of policies and also, rhetorical ploys that the Trump administration had used, especially in its final year, especially during the year of COVID, that he is, studiously avoiding. And I think that seems to be what he's threading. They've obviously not been quiet about some of these issues, like on Xinjiang, right? We just saw another set of sanctions after Anchorage that the EU has also signed on to. So, yeah, I think that seems to be the logic here, is they can separate things that potentially do have that kind of blowback and things that don't.
Megan, what do you make of that, of the idea that a box the Trump administration put Biden here, or policy turds left in the on the floor, as Kaiser put it?
I think that the Trump administration has made things very difficult for the Biden administration on a number of fronts. That he was not a policy guy, and he had some policy guys on his staff, but he tended to overrule them sort of whimsically. He had very strong opinions about certain issues, of which China was one, and he followed them, as his experts sort of dug in their heels and grabbed his coat sleeves and desperately tried to hold him back. And I think that it is going to be, and going far beyond China, right? I think that foreign policy is an area where Joe Biden is going to be doing a lot of repair work. But I also think, I will say that I think that Donald Trump also brought us to have a conversation about China that was a lot more sophisticated than I think certainly the general public conversation was 5 years ago, where I confess I was part of the they'll get richer, they'll liberalize, no two countries with McDonald's have ever gone to war together, etc. I think it is now clearer than it was that China is a major strategic rival, that they intend to act that way, and part of that may indeed be what Trump did, but a lot of that is simply that China is a nation pursuing its own self-interest, and the United States also has to pursue its own self-interest without having kind of rose-colored blinders on about how closely markets can bring us into rapprochement.
Christine, what do you make of that challenge for the Biden administration trying to lead out of that rhetoric from the Trump administration? But as Megan notes, there has been, I think, a bipartisan shift to be more wary of Chinese global power. Is that shift a mistake, or is that something that Biden needs to find his non-Trumpy way to lean into?
Yeah, no, I don't think that's a mistake, kind of for all the reasons that Megan mentioned. One thing that Biden said in this conference was that, in a recent phone call with Xi, he said that he doesn't want confrontation, but expects there to be competition. And I think that's exactly correct. And, we're going to see what Biden does to make sure that we hopefully come out kind of on top in that competition over the next 4 years. But I think there is an understanding and an acknowledgement that our two countries are not necessarily going to be the best of friends going forward, that there is some tension and yes, competition that will need to be addressed with, kind of a firm hand and a firm idea of what to do to get out front.
Kaiser, you mentioned those EU sanctions, and one of Biden's themes has been, trying to rebuild global alliances so that we have, we have partners that we can work with when we are trying to counterbalance China in the world. What should we be watching for that over the next year as Biden tries to implement a strategy along those lines?
So I think we shouldn't assume that the United States is now going to be back in the good graces of all our allies or of regional powers in Asia who we want to enlist in a project of countering China, of balancing China. The other thing that we should watch out for is I think we're not exactly exercising security dilemma sensibility and recognizing, how this sounds to Beijing. On the one, we say in one breath that we, would like to avoid any, we're not trying to thwart China's rise. We're not trying to contain China. As Obama used to say, a stable, wealthy, and strong China is in the interests of the U.S. as well. Now, you can't say that in the same breath, talk about building a coalition of democratic countries that's meant specifically to counter your rise, or, to say, as Joe Biden said, we're not going to allow China to surpass the U.S., in wealth or in, innovative capacity, not on my watch, right? I mean, we're not the only country that's shedding rose-colored glasses. Our allies have too, right, about the United States and about China. And China has shed some of its own. I think my chief worry is that the debate over whether the United States, in its heart of hearts, wants to actually thwart China's rise and to contain China, to see China driven to its knees, is essentially over in China, and they've decided that, irrespective of president or party, this is a national project of the United States. That's really worrisome to me. I think we need to be careful not to reinforce that belief in China.
But is that wrong? Is that Chinese belief wrong? I mean, because I think, you know, that there are certain aspects of our foreign policy that have gotten more partisan over the last few years, but I'm not sure that China is one of them. I think that the Obama lines about that, you know, a strong and wealthy China is in the global interest. I'm not sure that's something that you would hear Joe Biden say right now. I think that, you know, obviously Trump made himself, at least rhetorically, a bigger China hawk than anybody else could be. But I think that I think that shift in the United States, that is a shift that's on both parties. And if you wanted to disabuse China of that idea, I think you would need a substantive shift in the viewpoints in the Democratic Party rather than just a shift in rhetoric. Am I wrong about that?
So I think that while we definitely have to recognize that there's some bipartisan agreement on this, but you're still going to find much more strenuous, hawkish voices on the right than you will on the left. On the left, you'll hear a lot of people talking about the role that human rights should play in foreign policy. You'll hear a lot of criticism of China on issues of trade, but you don't hear the kind of gratuitous insults, the kind of positively zero-sum thinking that you have in the Republican Party.
We're going to leave that there. Kaiser Kuo is editor-at-large at SupChina and co-host and co-founder of the Seneca podcast. Kaiser, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
We've reached that time once again for our famed left, right, and center rants featuring pet peeves from across the political spectrum. Megan McArdle, it's your soapbox.
At a congressional media hearing on misinformation and social media, Jack Dorsey, the CEO of Twitter, said that the company had made a total mistake barring users from sharing the Post's October report about Hunter Biden's emails. If you remember this, they actually locked the New York Post out of their account for 2 weeks. However, when he was asked who had made this decision, Jack Dorsey refused to say. This actually goes to a broader problem with tech companies. Shortly after Christmas, I got into trouble with my Amazon Associates account because Amazon Associates apparently thought that I had emailed out links, referral links, in an email that I do about annual kitchen gift guide suggestions. I had not done that. I had used a program that automatically strips those links from emails that it sends, but it took me almost a month of back and forths and mailing screenshots to fix that with Amazon. Moreover, they wouldn't actually even tell me what I was accused of having done until I had already proven that I hadn't done it. The lack of transparency actually undermines the faith in the ability of these platforms to deal fairly and in a timely manner with their user base. And that is actually heightening the Republican fears about what might happen unless they rein in the ability of those companies to make moderation decisions. If they want to take some of the pressure off in Washington, they should start telling people upfront and in advance what might get them banned.
Christine Emba, what's on your mind?
So what's the deal with Joe Manchin? The West Virginia senator is the only Democrat not signed on to co-sponsor the For the People Act, H.R. 1. And this Thursday, he said that the Senate shouldn't pursue that act without Republican support. Yes, he wants a bipartisan voter reform bill. Frankly, Manchin is either being horrifyingly disingenuous or kind of stupid. And I just can't believe that he's that dumb, so it must be disingenuous. To claim to want a bipartisan voting rights bill in this day and age is purely bad faith. Republicans do not want to expand voting rights. They want to shrink them, especially for minorities and in Democrat-favoring districts. This is explicitly their strategy for survival. So no, Joe Manchin, there's not going to be Republican support for any Democratic and really American voting priorities, like anything that would improve voter administration, racial equity in voting access, voting rights, or campaign finance reform. And that means that if he's waiting for this, H.R. 1 will obviously fail, disappointing the majority of Americans who favor voting reform and his caucus. Joe Manchin clearly loves playing the wild card spoiler and holding his caucus hostage, but this has grown tiresome. It's possible that the people of West Virginia have whispered that they hate seeing people, I don't know, vote on Sundays. But the bill has bipartisan support. Both a majority of Democrat and Republican voters polled support it. So, Joe, what's the deal? Get it together. Do the right thing.
For my rant, United Airlines announced this week that they will launch nonstop service between Milwaukee, Wisconsin, and Portland, Maine. Now, why am I talking about that? Obviously, you know, this is just one airline route. It's kind of a weird one between two cities that are not very large, but it actually points to two significant phenomena that we are going to see in the economy as the year progresses that lead to a third significant phenomenon. United, like all these airlines, has lots of planes sitting around because of the decline in air travel, and the decline has been sharper and more persistent in business travel than in leisure travel. As people are getting back to normal, that means more that they're trying to figure out how to go on vacation again than that they're going to go on lots of business trips for in-person meetings. And that means that the hubs that these airlines built in the middle of the country, built around having lots of frequencies for business travel, that's not going to come back right away. The other thing that's not going to come back right away is international leisure travel. As the U.S. proceeds faster with immunizations than most countries in Europe do, and as there continue to be restrictions on international travel, a lot of people, as they go out for their first trips, that trip is not going to be abroad. So what does that mean that airlines and airline passengers are going to do this summer? They may be looking for new domestic vacation destinations, like Portland, Maine. And so as we start to see the rebound of the hospitality and transportation sectors in the United States, people returning to work, which is what we really want to see this year, a phenomenon that I expect to see is a significant increase in domestic leisure travel from people who might have not been traveling for that reason, but for other reasons. So that's a good sign. It's a good sign for Maine. And it's yet another small but hopeful sign about the economic recovery that we are going to see as we get into this year. That's all we have time for today. I want to thank Christine Emba, Megan McArdle, and Kaiser Kuo. Left, Right, and Center is produced by Sarah Fay and recorded and mixed by Michael Stark and Kat Yor. Todd M. Simon composed our theme music. I'm Josh Barrow. Thanks for joining us, and tune in next week for more Left, Right, and Center.
Download and subscribe at kcrw.com/LRC, the KCRW app, or wherever you find podcasts. Left, Right, and Center is produced and distributed by KCRW.